Congratulations, one and all. You are on the verge of surviving another week of American politics. To celebrate, though, I've got some more stories for you, including some monumentally important ones. We're going to be taking a look back at the first year of the Russian invasion of Ukraine in all of its brutality, all of its horror, and a bunch of other news besides. Massive developments on both the Democratic and Republican side of this incipient presidential primary, and a lot more besides. George Santos trying to win the right wing back over. We'll figure out if it's going to work. The we, though, is me, John Arola, and also the king of Rebel HQ, David Schuster. How's it going?
No royalty in Rebel HQ, but John, on such a really seriously, on such a busy news week, an incredible news period, it's a particular honor to be on with you to talk about it all.
Thank you, much appreciated. There might not technically be royalty, but I think it's well earned. And as we were talking about before the show, you've got some big stuff coming out over this weekend.
Yeah, we've got a great video coming out, another police interaction involving Sean Paul Reyes, Long Island audit. He's one of the nation's best and perhaps most polite auditors. And we're looking at a video he did in Minnesota. His interaction with the police there is remarkable and striking. And that's all I'll say. We'll probably publish it sometime this weekend.
Yeah, 100%. Well, look, everyone, we got a lot of news we're going to talk about. We want to make sure that everyone on our side is by our side. So please hit the like button, share the stream so people know we're live. They'll get the notifications and all that stuff that seems like it should be automatic on YouTube when you've subscribed, but for some reason never is. So if you could do that, that would really help us out. And if you want to reach out to us with any comments, tweets, super chats, anything like that, you can do so. We'll respond as we go. You know, maybe you'll get a laugh. Maybe it'll be an insightful point. Let us know about breaking news. Maybe you'll even get a Blue Apron gift card. The only way to find out is to send in an awesome comment. With all that said, though, David, are you ready to do this thing?
Yeah, let's do it.
Okay, let's jump into this. Today marks 1 year since the launch of the Russian invasion of Ukraine. And we thought it would be a good time to take a look back at some of the highlights, lowlights of this barbaric war. To start us off, here are a few things that you might recall from the last year.
Let those Russian come here, she says. We are ready to greet them.
Firefighters tackling a blaze at a fuel depot in the Russian city of Belgorod. The governor there has accused Ukraine of sending helicopters to attack the oil storage tanks under the cover of darkness.
And the Russian column that has come down here has been absolutely hammered.
Ukraine didn't fall. Ukraine is alive and kicking.
So look, with 1 year of this war, that video could have been roughly a year long at the very least. But that does remind you of a few of the big events, some of the early acts of defiance that felt at the time like the defense of Snake Island as like a last thumb in the eye of the invader before the country falls. The citizenry, like that old woman standing up against them, felt like a last roar of defiance. And then you start to have these events where things start to turn. A few attacks actually going beyond the Ukrainian border that they say they weren't behind, but kind of seems like maybe they were. And all the way up into Vladimir Zelensky's announcement just in the last week that the country has not fallen and hasn't. The war is obviously far from over. For all we know, it'll go on for literally years, but a lot has happened in this year. We're gonna try to jump through a few more of those highlights, but David, what are your thoughts as we hit this anniversary mark?
Well, it was a year ago when some of the nation's most prominent mainstream broadcast journalists, Andrea Mitchell, like at NBC News, who were saying, she was suggesting Kiev is gonna fall within a week. And it, of course, it did not. And it suggests, well, first of all, the mainstream media, they have their own problems. But I think what was so striking, and so many people in the United States in particular, underestimated just how strongly Ukraine was gonna fight and how defiant they were gonna be in defending their country. And so they have turned this literally, instead of being a Russian romp through Ukraine, they have actually, Ukrainian forces have perhaps evened it out. And Russia doesn't have much more territory than it did a year ago. And the Russians have suffered more than 100,000 casualties, not as many casualties on the Ukrainian side. It is a remarkable turn of events over what a lot of people were anticipating a year ago.
Yeah, 100%. I mean, this really, this war can be broken down into a number of different phases, and it has been very difficult at any particular point to reliably predict what those developments are gonna be like. I mean, I know many people, a lot of people, including me, didn't think that the war would begin in the first place because it seemed like such a disastrously horrible idea to launch one. I was wrong about the start of the war. I would argue right about the nature of the consequences of the war for, at the very least, the Russian people, if not the oligarchs who nothing can really harm them. But I want to start off with one of the initial turning points. So you have the launch of the war. Many people who apparently had years of experience studying the region said that we're talking days before the fall of the government. Kyiv will fall. But that didn't actually happen. And that was the first big turning point. Despite protracted bombardments, you have Russian forces were unable to gain control of Kyiv. They faced massive logistical challenges with ground forces unable to move fuel, munitions, and material because of clogged roads or attacks against their convoys. I remember reporting on this 40-kilometer-long Russian convoy that had stalled and was being picked apart by drones and counterattacks from the Ukrainians. They eventually fully pulled out of that region by the end of the March, close to a year ago, stating that their focus would now be on capturing the eastern Donbas region. And then, of course, evidence of massive war crimes began to come out. Those have been a near constant. Mass graves have been found, reports of reprisal killings, rape, effectively allegations of genocide when it comes to the massive systemic moving of populations outside of the country where they actually live. I believe we actually have a little bit of a reminder of what was going on in Bucha. If we could bring up, we have a little bit of B-roll of how horrendous that was. The footage that came out of that initially was one of the first undeniable bits of video of just how terrible the attack and then the retreat of the Russian forces were. Forces from the Ukrainians and journalists coming back in and just finding bodies everywhere. We had known how terrible this war was to that point. I was actually listening to the first show we did about this earlier today, but it became kind of indisputable how barbaric this thing was once we saw the evidence of these war crimes. What do you think, David?
Yeah, barbaric would be an understatement. And I think maybe, people may not be surprised by, the barbarism on the Russian side or maybe even the Ukrainian side. But I think what is so surprising still, Russia is a superpower. Until a year ago, they had one of the most feared militaries in the world. I'm not sure anybody would have predicted that Russia would have had problems with its supply lines, with its munitions, with its supporting its own troops, with its command and control. And yet it seemed like Russia was fighting this war not as a superpower, but as a country that has a military that was not ready for something like this. And that's just shocking. And yes, a lot of credit to the Ukrainians for the way they've defended themselves and the defiance they put up in the face of such horrible brutality and war crimes. But a lot of this is also Russia's own fault because of how miserable they have been in the execution of this war.
Yeah. Yeah, and look, I know it's cliche at this point to declare that a war was needless, that it was pointless, but has there been a modern conflict more pointless, more needless from the point of view of the invading nation, like the people of the invading nation? Obviously, Vladimir Putin sees potential, either rhetorical or symbolic gain in this. But if you're like a regular person living in Russia, what the hell has this done for you, let alone the barbarity?
I almost sort of wanted to offer some historical connections, right? I mean, Stalin, it cost him 1 million Russian soldiers to try to get to Berlin at the end of World War II before the United States could get there. And there are a lot of historians who say, look, the Russian military has sort of a history of just throwing more and more people into a meat grinder to achieve their needs. So, I mean, look, you could say that, well, that's a very anti-Russian thing to say that they don't value the lives of their own soldiers or their own people. But it certainly, there's an argument to be made about that, not just because of historical situations like, the end of World War II, but also what we're seeing now. I mean, it just feels like more and more troops. And now, college students are being conscripted in the Russian forces and they're not prepared to fight. And yet they're just being thrown into the front lines without much concern about the death toll.
Yeah. Yeah. No, totally. We spent years criticizing the US for not caring nearly enough about the ongoing losses in Iraq and Afghanistan. And we were right to do so. But when it comes to willingly sacrificing forces, it's hard to find a country or a government anyway more prepared to do that historically than Russia or the Soviet Union before them. As we said, the war developed into, they're no longer going to take Kyiv. They're no longer going to be able to topple the government that way. They're going to try assassination strikes and things like that. But they'd move to trying to consolidate control over the eastern portions. And to give you an idea of some of the successes and failures of that, Bakhmut, one city, had a pre-war population of about 70,000 people. More recently, about 2,000 civilians remain in what's left of that city, and there isn't that much left in comparison to what it was like. So Russia was able to capture a few places, either wipe out the population there, move the population there, either back to Russia or people fleeing to somewhere where it might be safe. And eventually, starting in September, Kyiv launched a major counteroffensive, recaptured more than 3,000 square kilometers of territory in less than a week. By the end of September, they'd retaken more than 500 square kilometers as well, dozens of different settlements. And you might recall one of the, I guess, the points where it became sort of indisputable how this thing had turned, at least for then, was the destruction of the bridge connecting Crimea to Russia. So let's take a look at that, remind you.
Since the Tsar's time, people were dreaming to build this bridge. At last, thanks to your hard work, your talent, this project, this miracle has happened.
Well, that's actually the explosion, but yes, the reminder that it was considered this sort of crown jewel, that he had been there for the final construction of it, and it eventually was destroyed. Now, Ukraine does not take formal credit for this, and we could sort of understand why they wouldn't do that. I guess it was just a coincidence. I guess someone else did it. They were just, there's chaos. I'm gonna jump in there and do something about this, but that was considered very serious. And it was also, look, it's terrible for any infrastructure like this to be blown up, but the logistic difficulties that the Russians have had from the very beginning, like this is exacerbating that. They don't appear to have great equipment, which was a bit of a surprise. They don't seem to be well trained in the use of the equipment, but more important than that, they didn't seem from the very beginning to give a damn about what was actually brought out in the field. They were just expected to find food, find medical supplies, even in the initial push, let alone some of the later conscription, the mass, waves of people who'd gotten 2 or 3 days of training with guns. So taking out a bridge like that was strategically probably a wise move.
Oh, it was wise. It was a brilliant move by the Ukrainians or whoever did it. But here's the other part about it. Russia responded with heavy bombardments of Ukrainian infrastructure. And I think that was also the moment when a lot of people feared, is this when Russia is going to start to deploy tactical nuclear weapons on the battlefield to use their nukes to wipe out, tens of thousands of Ukrainian soldiers? Because the fear was that, Russia has it, it's eventually going to use whatever weapons in its arsenal it needs to gain back its territory that it wants to claim. The fact that Russia did not do that, that it still has not used nuclear weapons, I think a lot of credit has to go to the Biden administration, to other world powers, which have been able to put enough pressure on Russia to say, okay, you can fight, but there's certain boundaries. There's certain things that we, the rest of the world, are not going to tolerate. And thankfully, Putin has not yet deployed nuclear weapons.
Yeah, and there was a lot of fear, when they were fighting around one of the nuclear power facilities, there were concerns about what might happen with that and a lot of incredibly needlessly risky stuff being done around that. It has always felt to me like escalating this to the use of nuclear weapons right over the border from your country would be mad. But then again, invading it all was. So I understand the concerns ongoing about the use of weapons of mass destruction. I also, have to acknowledge that on a daily basis, some of the most intellectually dishonest people in American politics, like Marjorie Greene and Tucker Carlson, are using that threat, asserting that that is ultimately President Joe Biden's goal, that he desperately wants a nuclear war with Russia to justify whatever they want, stopping aid to Ukraine, a national divorce, locking up Hunter Biden, whatever it is. Joe Biden wants nuclear war, and so we should get whatever we want. That's been frustrated from the very beginning. I do want to just put a pin in our talk about how the war has moved back and forth over the territory of Ukraine with this very fascinating animated map of the changing battle lines. Yeah, so you could see that almost instantly a lot of territory was gained in just the first day or two of the war. And there have been big movements since then, but largely you've gotten more of a focus in the south and the east rather than some of the initial push into the north when Kyiv was the explicit target. And we're gonna have to see, they've talked about drafting up a million more soldiers or something like that. And so we'll see if that makes them more successful than some of their previous pushes into Ukraine. But I'm curious where you see this going forward. Like, I know it's difficult to predict, as we said, David, but any predictions for where we'll be when we recount the second year of this war?
Yeah, I mean, it is very hard to say, because on the one hand, you could make an argument that if Russia suddenly looked for an off ramp and decided, okay, we're going to pull back, you would be surprised by that, right? Because all they have is that little sliver, essentially, in eastern Ukraine that you just put up on the map. And this has been an abject failure for Russia. But can Vladimir Putin afford, because of his own internal politics, to essentially surrender and to give up on his dream of taking Ukraine back and making it part of Russia? And I'm not sure he can, and I'm not sure he will. So in my view, this keeps going. And I think you mentioned this could go on for years, maybe even decades. I think that's within the realm of possibility, that this is essentially a war of attrition that Russia tries to fight, and Ukraine simply tries to hang in there, perhaps with a lot of support from the West. But I'm also so glad, John, that you mentioned the Tucker Carlson's and Marjorie Taylor Greens, because the other element about this is, in the United States, one could argue that there are Russian agents, if not Russian agents, there are pro-Russian politicians in the United States who are saying this sort of crap about Joe Biden and about what Joe Biden wants. And I think in any other time, people would look at US politics and say, those people are insane. They need to be excommunicated from our political system. But in fact, they represent a growing number in the lunatic right-wing fringe of Republican politics of people who are pro-Russian, hate the idea that Biden has been helping Ukraine fight the Russians, and feel like there's some nefarious US conquering of Russia that is at hand here, which is absolutely nuts.
Yeah, and they were just saying that recently. It would seem hard to make the case that this is a war against Russia, a conquering of Russia, when Russia started the war and attacked another country, invading it. They've found a way to make that case. I don't understand it. I've been advocating from the very beginning for Russia to just turn the tanks around, go back over the border. You'll lose nothing unless you stay. You'll keep losing stuff then. And you're right to point out that, you know, there are these like broad, vague political calculations being made by Putin. What a sick situation for us to be in, just as a people, as a, you know, a collective human civilization, for those sorts of considerations to be worth tens of thousands of lives. Like, that other people who might look up to you, who support you, they'll die so that you can save metaphoric face. A weird state to be in. That said, there's a couple of other aspects of this I want to make sure that we talk about. From the very beginning, a lot of the conversation about the war in Ukraine here in the United States has been about what our obligation is, what our responsibility or duty is to assist Ukraine when they're being attacked in this way. And obviously, there's a lot of history that goes into that. Ukraine had willingly given up their weapons of mass destruction in exchange for, you know, the promises of future support. Worries about a precedent being set where, well, if we don't assist them, why would any country willingly give up these weapons if we can't tell them plausibly that we're going to help them? And I say we, I don't mean the United States, I mean, you know, the collective, you know, nations of the world, if we just allow this country to be conquered. So in any event, that debate has gone through a lot of different iterations, but along the way, a lot of money has been spent. Here is some of the updated figures, at least pledges of $77.6 billion from the United States. A significant chunk of the $166 billion in combined military, humanitarian, and financial aid that's been pledged by 40 different countries and groups, at least to roughly the beginning of this year. It's a lot of money. We are far and away the largest individual contributor. And David, there's a lot more, I think, opposition to that, very vocal opposition from right-wingers who've now taken over Congress, people like Tucker Carlson. I'm curious what you think about the state of that debate.
Well, and it gets to, you know, look, Republicans don't have a problem spending money when they have their president as a Republican and a Republican Congress, perhaps. And then it's, okay, Katie barred the door, let's spend as much money as we need on military and middle to military industrial complex. Now that the Democrats have control of the White House, of course, for the last 2 years, it's, oh, no, wait a second, now we need to be more thrifty. We need to be more careful about how we spend money in general. And then, oh, by the way, the fact that the United States is helping Ukraine try to protect its freedom, somehow that becomes a problem for a lot of Republicans who for so many years said, well, the reason that we need a super strong military where we spend more than the next 10 military budgets combined around the world is because we need to protect freedom. We need to protect democracy. Well, okay, that's what we're doing now by trying to help Ukraine, but somehow that's too much money. So it doesn't make a lot of sense in terms of the political right for me.
Yeah. A lot of that, like that lofty language, you know, it seemed pretty clear from the beginning that that was just being used to justify massive spending, and it wasn't an actual, honest ideological commitment. That's been proven many times over. Look, I don't know how ready the Republican Party is going to be to approve of, you know, greater pledges. We've had minor additional pledges just in the last week or so. And it also might be that even if more money is allocated going forward, that there might be the expectation of either more diplomatic pressure being tied to it, or to the extent that that might already exist, more acknowledgement of it, perhaps. So I'm curious if you have any thoughts about, like, people have been saying that it should be tied to a willingness to make concessions to Russia going forward, let them keep the eastern portion or whatever. As of right now, Vladimir Zelensky seems to have no interest in anything like that.
You know, it's a good point. I think, you look, politically, you're going to see sort of a difference between the U.S. House, Republican-controlled, and the U.S. Senate, which is sort of an even split. And in the Senate, you have Lindsey Graham, a number of Republican sort of hawks who are adamant about continuing to keep funding Ukraine, to send them tens of billions of dollars. So, and I think that's where the administration will continue to be able to go. And I think the House will essentially grudgingly go along with some Republicans saying, no, we need to spend money here at home. But I think the Congress is going to continue to approve the budgets. It would be really interesting at a certain point, though, if there's a serious peace plan that is put on the table, and the United States can then say, okay, look, here's some conditions that we need you to say to embrace in order for the money to keep going. There's been a peace plan put forward by the Chinese, which is not seen as that serious by a lot of, you know, foreign policy experts in the United States. But nonetheless, I think there should come a point where the money is hinged upon Ukraine being able to accept some sort of rational end to all this, as opposed to a war of attrition.
Yeah. Well, as of right now, at least, I know this doesn't, I think, factor into the conversation much, but I was curious, what do the American people actually think about this? Because at the end of the day, maybe it shouldn't just come down to what Marjorie Greene thinks. 48% in a recent Associated Press, NORC, Center for Public Affairs research poll say they favor the US providing weapons to Ukraine, 29% opposed, 22% say they're neither favor nor opposed. So less than one third actually are opposed to this continuing. It was higher back in May 2022, 60% said that they were in favor of sending Ukraine weapons. So some drop in that, it's still the plurality. In terms of just sending direct government funds, 37% are in favor, 38% opposed. So that is much more divisive, the just direct transfer of money rather than spending money here and sending it over. Also, oddly enough, like, while the Republicans would be against, at least rhetorically against both of those, in theory, spending the money on weapons here and sending them is the end goal of all of the military industrial complex anyway. Do you especially care who's pointing the rifle after it's been paid for? They say that they do. I have a feeling that whatever money goes allocated to them, it's just going to be allocated to our military anyway. So if you're a conservative, understand, they're not talking about cutting spending on the military, just that, you know, the packages might go domestically rather than international.
Yeah, and the other part about it is, that's such a great point, because the military-industrial complex, they do have their own lobbyists, which will twist the arms of Republicans in the House who may be opposed to sending more aid and say, look, this is going to be another few thousand jobs for Raytheon or any of these companies that are producing these weapons. But the other part about it is, you mentioned the sort of poll. I think there's sort of there's a characteristic of Americans who, we like to bet on winners. I think if Ukraine had been getting creamed and they had not been able to hold the territory, I think Americans would be far more reluctant to provide them with more and more money. But because Ukraine looks like they're right in this fight, there's a chance they might be able to expel the Russians. I think as long as they're able to put up that very strong defense, you will continue to see Americans saying, hey, let's invest more and more money in helping them try to win this thing.
Yeah, I think that that's 100% right. I think that there is socially, we like an underdog. I think that that plays into it. They're aided by the fact that, you know, Ukrainians are white. So a lot of Americans are going to find that to be much more sympathetic than if this was a conflict that was happening in a different part of the world. So let's not forget the racial component to all of this that played into some of the initial conversation about migrants and all that. And also, while, you know, the Republicans now have, you know, people like Marjorie Greene and Tucker Carlson who are every day trying to convince their base that Vladimir Putin is the coolest guy ever, those same Republican viewers had decades of Fox News telling them that the communist regime was so bad and everything. So there's got to be a little bit of lingering confusion on the part of, like, regular conservatives. Like, wasn't this guy supposed to be bad? I get that he's trying to drive the LGBTQ community in Russia into the shadows. I like that, but I feel like my entire life you were telling me he was bad. So maybe there's some confusion there.
Yeah, and look, you're absolutely right. I mean, Fox News, the majority of the Republican Party, for so long advocated a strong U.S. foreign policy, engagement, using U.S. power, military and otherwise, to sort of dictate the terms of the world the way the United States wanted. I think there's always been something of a sort of sliver within the Republican Party that the Pat Buchanan types who say, hey, no, we need to draw back in. We need to not care as much about foreign policy, take our troops home, focus more on the United States and sort of this anti-U.S. involvement. And some of that strain is sort of bubbling up now with Tucker Carlson and Marjorie Taylor Greene. I think it's not just all that they love Russia, but they are part of this sort of political wing, which increasingly thinks America first, only America. That's all we should care about. It's a real divide within the Republican Party and sort of fascinating to watch them argue it. I just think that the isolationists, if you want to call them that, they're not going to be able to go very far in the current climate, the way things are going in Ukraine.
Yeah, I think so. Well, look, there's a lot of other aspects of this that I would like to get to. We might touch on them in the break, but there's so much more news to get to. And don't you worry, the war is gonna continue and we will be continuing to provide critical coverage of it. That said, stick around on the other side of this. We're gonna be touching base with the state of the Republican and Democratic sides of the presidential primary. We'll be right back.
What are the differences in terms of policy positions that, for example, you may have with President Trump?
Probably not very many at all. I am so thankful that we have President Trump in office.
Dude, you're supposed to be running against him. Why don't any of them understand this on the Republican side? All of them are challenging him. And I get that they're scared of what he's gonna say, what he's gonna do. Tim Scott's probably terrified, rightly so, of what the nickname Trump is gonna give him will be. Like, not being willing to differentiate yourself from him is not gonna stop those attacks. You are, by the very nature of your challenge, trying to stop him from becoming president again. I think he's gonna realize that. David, what do you think?
I'm baffled that a Republican like Tim Scott doesn't have an answer. Even if his answer is, oh no, I have the same policies as Donald Trump, but I believe I'm better situated because of less personal baggage, because of fewer negatives, to be able to carry out policies like lower taxation, breaks to corporations, isolation, whatever the policy is. But for him not to be able to articulate that in like a 10 or 15 second answer shows this is not a guy who is ready for a presidential campaign. Yeah. And this is a lesson for other Republicans too. You're gonna be asked this over and over. And if you're afraid to differentiate yourself from Donald Trump on policy, that's fine, but you have to differentiate yourself from him on something else.
Yeah, 100%. Well, look, maybe we're being unfair. After all, Sean Hannity is a pro. He's gonna ask follow-up questions. Here's a second attempt to get Tim Scott to differentiate himself.
Might we then find ourselves in a position where, you know, maybe we'll have 6, 7, 8, maybe 10, maybe 20 Republican candidates on a stage that mostly agree on what the governing philosophy and ideology should be for the country, what works for the country? Then where are the differences? What would the differences be, do you think?
Yeah, that's a great question, Sean. I would simply say this, what I'm learning on my Faith in America tour is as I tell my story as an African American who was born into poverty and then a single parent household.
So, spoiler alert, he doesn't actually end up differentiating himself. To be clear, he does focus on his background, the perspective that his life experience gives him, which I think is actually incredibly different from Donald Trump. I think that there is value to that. I'm not a Republican voter, though. They supposedly hate that identity politics stuff. So I don't know how far that's gonna get him. Well, I respect it. But anyway, no, he's not willing to actually say why you should vote for him rather than for Donald Trump, which would seem to undercut your challenge just a bit.
And he got so close, right? Because he could have used that background and say, because I'm from the poverty and African American, this is why conservative policies mean more to me and why I believe in them and I can have a better message about. I mean, so it's not like you can't use your sort of background and say, okay, our background is very different. But again, you gotta have that answer ready. You can't just say, well, I'm on my faith tour and I'm an African American, I grew up in poverty. No, you have to link it to what the question was. How are you different? If your policy is the same, then it's your background that makes you different in my ability to carry out the policy because of my something. Give the audience something, because right now they're looking at Tim Scott and saying, I'm never going to vote for this guy. He's not ready.
Yeah, it just comes off as weak and mealy mouthed and wishy washy. I mean, you presumably have been thinking about this for a while, right? You should have something ready to go. Maybe that something would collapse under pressure, but you got to have a paragraph that you've memorized.
Right.
But to be fair, I don't want to focus just on him. While Tim Scott, I think, embarrassed himself by not being willing to distance himself from Donald Trump on substance, he is hardly alone in that. Vivek Ramaswamy, who announced his race earlier this week, similarly didn't want to do that.
What are the policy differences you have between yourself and Donald Trump?
So first of all, Donald Trump's a friend. I'm not running against him. I am running on a vision for our nation.
Wait a minute, but you're not running for him. You're running against him. Let's be honest.
I'm running for our country. But let's talk about differences, because I'm with you, Sean. He was the OG of America First. I'm taking that to the next level with America First 2.0.
Okay, so he's great. He's awesome. You should probably just vote for him. But I'm gonna do more of what he did, which, admittedly, at least is policy based. It's not a difference. He goes on to say what he's going to do. It's all America First stuff. It's the exact same thing. The only thing that he said that I haven't heard Trump say in these exact words is Vivek Ramaswamy wants to set an 8-year limit on people working for the federal government. After that, you're gone. You can't do it anymore, which is super weird. But that's at least a specific difference. Everything else was just Donald Trump stuff. He's not willing to criticize Trump. He's not going to insult Donald Trump. Thus, he is technically challenging him, but not especially challenging him.
Well, and the challenge that Vivek has is nobody knows who, I mean, look, most people don't know who Vivek is. This is a strange, random guy. So he's got to be able to say in that response, look, I am an entrepreneur, whatever his background is. And where I'm different from Donald Trump is because I did my business this way and because I stand for these policies. And yes, I believe in limited, whatever it is. But again, here's another, what was he talking about? OG and then 2.0, I mean, I'm lost. And most voters, again, are gonna look up and say, who is this guy? Why should we bother spending any time with this guy? He's not answering the question. He's not giving a clear reason for why he's on my television screen.
Yeah, and by the way, he's not even right. So a bit of a fact check coming from the Twitch chat. Fat guy named Tiny points out, the OG of America First was Woodrow Wilson in 1916. Again, stop giving Trump credit for stuff he doesn't deserve it. But no, that was again weak stuff. None of them are willing to challenge him. So you had Tim Scott, you have Vivek Ramaswamy, you have Nikki Haley repeatedly declining to criticize Trump or even say how she's different, other than some veiled attacks against his advanced age. So she's younger than him. I guess that's a difference. Mike Pence, who thankfully survived the attempt by MAGA people to hang him, has largely avoided confronting Donald Trump, has only said that there will be better choices than Trump in 2024. Very, very bold. Even Ron DeSantis, who has been called both a meatball and a pedophile by Donald Trump in recent weeks, will not actually directly attack Trump or directly differentiate himself. And he's supposed to be the strongest challenger. And he should really be worried, because while Nikki Haley and Mike Pence and Vivek Ramaswamy and Tim Scott are not willing to directly attack Trump, they're still gonna be running. They're still gonna potentially get 1 or 2 or 3 points of the vote. And I'm going to make the prediction that they're not gonna be taking that vote away from Trump much of the time. If they're taking it from anyone, it's going to be Ron DeSantis.
You're absolutely right, Sean. And I'd say, you know, what we're seeing here, and maybe there is a wise political strategy this early in the race not to infuriate Donald Trump, not to become sort of the target of his meat grinder. And I can understand that. But the way you deal with that is, instead of, you know, when Sean Hannity says, how are your policy differences? You can say, look, I'm not exactly sure where President Trump stands, but here's where I stand right now. And at least you put your own policy, because most people are probably not going to remember, you know, what Donald Trump's policies were over 4 years. It was so sort of confusing. So why not use this opportunity to introduce yourself, introduce your policies if you're Ron DeSantis or a Vivek or Senator Scott, and then wait for Sean Hannity to say, okay, but that's the same policy as Donald Trump. And then at the second response, you're like, oh, well, but I'm more effective about carrying out this policy because of the following this difference, something.
Yeah.
But, you know, I'm amazed again just how unprepared a lot of these folks are. And it makes me think that, okay, maybe there's also, you know, Republican strategists and coaches who are also very silent right now and are just not involved.
Yeah, maybe. Look, my guess would be what we're seeing is not a slate of credible, serious challengers. What we're seeing is a debate stage of weasels. So they're gonna technically run while never offending Donald Trump and probably implicitly taking support away from Ron DeSantis, who right now can't afford to lose that support. And if they do this for long enough and Trump wins, maybe they get a position in his cabinet. I mean, they never insulted him along the way. And if things look like they're shifting to Ron DeSantis, then they can strategically drop out before an important race and maybe get some support from Ron DeSantis once he wins the nomination. This just, I can't say for sure, I'm not a psychic or whatever, but this feels strategic in a really weaselly way.
Yeah, strategic but stupid, right? Because again, sure, you say you wanna protect yourself with Donald Trump and the possibility that he wins, and you don't wanna be on his enemies list. But again, you can do that, you can be strategic and protect Donald Trump, but at the same time, increase your own profile by saying, well, here's what I stand for. Or, you know, Donald Trump's pretty old and I'm a younger guy, and God forbid something should happen to Donald Trump. We need somebody to carry on this movement about isolationist America, for something that shows people you are different and that you think for yourself.
Yeah, 100%, 100%. Okay, really fast, I wanna check in on the other side of the aisle. So whenever we're ready, why don't we jump into this? Marianne Williamson, who ran in the Democratic primary the last time around, has launched her bid to challenge Joe Biden, assuming he runs. And very early on, she announced that part of it was some of the moves Joe Biden and the Democratic Party have made to try to make it more difficult for challengers in the future, saying, how can you claim to be a champion of democracy when your own process is so undemocratic? That is, of course, a reference to something we've already covered on the show, the DNC announcing a sweeping overhaul of the Democratic primary process, in particular, which states are gonna be voting first. And these are not small changes. Democrats voted to endorse a proposal that starts the 2024 Democratic presidential primary circuit on February 3rd in South Carolina. New Hampshire and Nevada are scheduled to follow on February 6th, Georgia on February 13th, and then Michigan on February 27th. I think that there is a very plausible case to be made that this is better representative of the Democratic Party and all of that stuff. It's also seems to be designed to help Joe Biden and people like him win presidential primaries. Both of those things can be true at the same time. This is gonna give a lot more early political power and representation to black voters inside of the Democratic primary. It is just also the fact that Joe Biden believes that that will help him more than some potentially progressive challengers. We'll see how that plays out in reality. But I like that Marianne Williamson is, again, we've been talking about people not being willing to differentiate themselves. She's focusing on a big change that maybe could have been handled in a different way and saying that she is going to be a credible challenger. She obviously had difficulty generating a massive base last time around, but she raised some interesting issues. We interviewed her here on the show in studio. David, what do you think about this? I believe the first announced challenger to Joe Biden?
Well, I'm not sure that she is gonna be the strongest candidate, but she is absolutely right about the DNC having its thumb on the scale to help Joe Biden and to tamp down any challengers, progressive or otherwise. I mean, you look back to, you know, 2020, and Bernie Sanders did super well in Iowa, New Hampshire, that sort of catapulted him. He was in the catbird seat, and then the Democrats decided to coalesce around Joe Biden, and he won South Carolina, and that sort of stopped the bleeding, and Joe Biden goes on to the nomination. So by starting with South Carolina, again, a Joe Biden stronghold, and again, the first primary race, the first caucus or primary race gets huge attention from the media and helps whoever is, you know, wins get huge amounts of donations and more power and momentum. So this is the Joe Biden reelection for a nomination plan to help him. I just think though that it becomes even more interesting if Joe Biden has some sort of health issues in the next couple of months, decides that he cannot run. That, you know, maybe this is also part of the DNC saying, okay, well, now we're gonna make sure that at least a progressive who might do well in a Democratic Iowa, Democratic New Hampshire primary cannot do the same thing in 2020 that Bernie Sanders did. And this essentially plants the seed for any sort of establishment Democrat to get off to a great start if it's not Joe Biden.
Yeah, maybe, although I have to imagine when this was announced, Pete Buttigieg is probably like, oh, shucks. Because I don't think he's gonna do real well with this map. That said, I'm kind of in a weird position because I don't like when something like this is done so clearly to benefit one politician. But I also think, why shouldn't those states get to vote first rather than having to sort of just like rubber stamp what had already been going on? Why should it be Iowa? New Hampshire is still in there, but at least it's not only New Hampshire and Iowa. Nevada, by the way, is a state that Bernie Sanders has done very well in. He won it the last time around. I get that, at least for Joe Biden, he seems to have an advantage in some of these early states, but why shouldn't a progressive be able to do well in Georgia? And why shouldn't you need to win over those sorts of states to be the candidate? So I'm really torn. I don't like the backroom deals, but I also think that there's no reason why progressives should needlessly concede that this whole portion of the country isn't a place they can do well in. I mean, why would that be the case? I don't know.
Right. And I would argue that let's just, for argument's sake, let's suppose Joe Biden is not running and Bernie Sanders says, I'm going to give this another shot. I think if Bernie Sanders is starting in a place like South Carolina, where he can make his economic populist appeals, as opposed to only having a couple of days after Iowa, New Hampshire, and suddenly rushing into South Carolina and hoping for the momentum, if he can start with this message for a couple of months in South Carolina, I actually think the progressive message there would do very well with Democrats who just haven't been exposed to it that much. And then if you do well in South Carolina, you go to, you know, favorable turf in Iowa, New Hampshire, and suddenly, you know, maybe you've won the first three and the nomination is yours. And at that point, the establishment cannot stop you. So there may be some advantages here for progressives because they can take their message for several weeks now to South Carolina and say, this is the first one. We have to concentrate on South Carolina first. And I think they could do well.
Well, we'll see. We're gonna be covering it in depth. That said, we're gonna take our second break. When we come back, though, George Santos needs to win back the right wing base. He's got a little idea. We're gonna debate whether it might work. Okay, everybody. David, are you ready to get a little bit weird with the news?
I'm always ready for weird stuff.
Okay, let's jump into this. George Santos is signing on to a plan to make the AR-15 America's national gun, because we need that. We need more acknowledgement of the AR-15. I've always felt that we get a lot of acknowledgement of the AR-15 on like a 2 or 3 times a week basis when someone picks one up to kill as many civilians as they can. But he thinks it deserves more credit. And honestly, I think there's some merit to it. Why shouldn't the AR-15 be one of the symbols of the United States? I personally think throw a couple of wings on one, it should be our national bird. I think the symbol for the US, like Rushmore, just get rid of all those faces and just have a massive AR-15 style rifle with a big banana clip and a scope. I think that says America more than anything else. But he is serious, George Santos. Representative Barry Moore is the one who's actually putting this out, saying the Second Amendment is an American right just as much as freedom of speech, religion, and the press. And George Santos and some others are signing on to it. Schuster, what do you think?
George Santos ought to have his face also on Mount Rushmore, because he is the poster child of everything that is wrong with American politics, and a lot, of course, which is wrong with the Republican Party. This guy is a total fraud. He's a complete liar. He's lied about everything, but there he is, co-sponsoring legislation, including something this ridiculous. There are 20 million AR-15s in the United States. I think it's one for every 17 people, 20 million. There's more than 400 million firearms total in the United States, more than we have people. And yet somebody wants to celebrate this. Somebody wants to celebrate the fact that, oh, you can easily kill lots of your fellow members of your community or school or whatever it is in just a couple of seconds with this gun. Why is that something to celebrate? Only in the perverse world of the lunatics like George Santos would that be something to be proud of.
100%. But by the way, I liked your idea, but I got a text message from the representative. His face is on Mount Rushmore. I didn't know that. Also, he doesn't like our criticism since he did invent the AR-15, he reminds me. So yes, he's a man of many talents. It's such a weird thing. I don't know, David, what your big hobby is, but I'll say that if my hobby involved a thing the box for Eldritch Horror, the board game, that people routinely used to murder as many kids as they can, I would look for a different hobby probably at some point. Why don't they think it's weird that they love the exact same thing as every prospective mass murderer in America? Isn't that weird?
It is weird, and you bring up a valid point. One of my hobbies is tennis. If people were hacking each other to death with tennis rackets over and over, I would be totally in favor of, okay, let's do all sorts of background checks on people who have tennis rackets. Let's make sure that they are actually signing up for court time and not just buying a racket to hit somebody over the head. And let's do everything we can to make sure that we minimize the danger. You don't glorify weapons. There's something about in this culture, we glorify celebrities, we glorify money, and we glorify weapons. And that is a terrible combination.
100%. And by the way, don't at me. I know that not everyone who owns an AR-15 is desperately hoping to kill as many people. And this is not just an anti-gun thing. I like guns. I've shot many, many guns. This particular style of weapon is indisputably beloved by people whose goal it is to kill as many humans as possible. That's just the truth. Sorry. Okay, with that said, we got one more topic. We're gonna fit into the first hour of our show. Why don't we jump into this?
70% of Republicans in Arizona think the election was stolen and fraudulent.
Right. I feel like I understand that's f-ing crazy. You've still investigating.
We've run a lot of the stuff to ground.
And when you get it to ground, will you come out and say Donald J. Trump is wrong? The election in Arizona was fair, not stolen, and not fraudulent.
I've always been a straight shooter, and once all the facts and evidence are in, John, come on, man.
So why can't you say the election in 2020 was not stolen or fraudulent?
I will tell you this, as I said.
This is blowing my mind.
It's blowing my mind too, but it turns out now with new developments, there was always a reason he couldn't say that it hadn't been stolen, and that was that he was absolutely terrified of Donald Trump. He's terrified of the Republican base. Here's not the reason that he couldn't say it, that he didn't know that it wasn't stolen, because it turns out he had already at that point, that was 2022, he'd already known for 2 years definitively that it hadn't been stolen. And this is coming thanks to a Democratic Attorney General Chris Mays, who took office last month and can now unveil the records from when that chucklehead was the attorney general. Because apparently in March 2022, there was a summary of the investigative findings of Arizona, and he didn't put it out because it showed that there hadn't been fraud, that the fraud claims being spread by Trump and his allies wasn't true. He just sat on it. A month later, he released an interim report. It wasn't interim, they were already done. He just didn't want it to be released, that claimed his investigation, quote, revealed serious vulnerabilities that must be addressed and raises questions about the 2020 election in Arizona. That wasn't true. Their report was done and showed that that wasn't true. His interim report actually received pushback from his own investigators, who said that some of its claims were already refuted by the inquiry that they had completed at that point. And so this is why we're worried about people like this, massive lying grifters getting into positions of power, because they will just knowingly lie about the results to manipulate the outcome. Thank you to the new attorney general for shedding light on this, by the way. Schuster, what do you think?
Bearing the facts, I mean, we see that over and over within the Republican Party, that if facts come up that are so obvious, well, you just don't talk about them. Or you say, well, it hasn't been resolved yet, as this, you know, a former attorney general was suggesting. No, it was resolved. And again, why are people, I get in some way, you're afraid of Donald Trump, you're afraid that he will end your political career, but how could a political career be worth anything if this is how dishonest and unethical you are? If all you stand for is your own reelection, your own political power, and you don't stand for any shame, for any integrity, for any version of the truth, what use are you? This is such a wasted political life, such a wasted life anyway. And I just, the number of people who fall into this trap is somehow just get addicted to the celebrity, and that's all they want. They just want to have their name in the news, even if their name is in the news now, because it's associated with shame.
Yeah, because they've done terrible things. They want the fame, they want the money, they want the power. That is explicitly what he wanted. He was in a primary to try to run for Senate, and he was being pressured by Trump. And so he lied to all of the people that he had an ethical obligation to be honest with. Thankfully, there was a bit of karma in this case. He lost that primary bid. So he lied to his entire state for no gain whatsoever. Great plan, buddy.
Oops.
Anyway, that is That is all the time we have for the first hour of our show. Thank you, everyone who's been watching or is listening on the podcast. Much appreciated. Coming up in the aftermath, though, we've got more news to get to and your garbage people of the week.
Thanks for listening to the full episode of The Damage Report. Support our work, listen ad-free, access members-only bonus content, and more by subscribing to Apple Podcasts at apple.co/TYT. I'm your host, John Adirola. I'll see you soon.